Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to look at the week that was, the past week. A number of notable things have occurred politically and economically that we need to address and comment on. So we're going to suspend for this week our analysis of the three great economists. We've covered Keynes, we covered Marx, we were going to do Adam Smith, but events of the past week, let's go back to return to contemporary time and actual reality here rather than theory, and discuss what's going on this past week. A number of things happened. Well, we got U.S. GDP first look for the second quarter. We need to comment on that. And a little more broadly, the first half of here, 2021, as we reopen the economy. So we're going to look at the composition here of the just reported U.S. Second quarter GDP, which is a very early look, you know, and usually gets some significant revision in the second release of the quarter GDP. There's always three releases. And then after that, the third is a third release, but it's very little change typically in third release. So the real preliminary look at the GDP for the second quarter will come in August, but we get an early preview here, subject to change. So we'll talk about first, you know, what's the composition of this GDP for second quarter? What does it portend? Put it in historical context a little bit here. Critique some of the hype that always goes around U.S. GDP releases. Then I want to talk about also this past week, the Federal Reserve's meeting, Chairman Powell. His comments on the Fed meeting here, you know, it's a big issue. Will the Fed start raising rates? Will the Fed signal rate increases, which they call the taper? You know, they're going to taper the amount of money that they throw into the economy, which will presumably lower or raise interest rates. If you taper it, in other words, you're taking money out of the economy or slowing down the amount you put in, you meaning the Fed. And therefore, that all things equal should raise interest rates. Of course, that's a very important topic because if you start raising interest rates and it's a weak recovery, it's not a recovery, it's a rebound, well, then you just add fuel to the fire and slow down the recovery even more, so the argument goes. So the Fed, what is the Fed saying this past week about raising rates? And more importantly, what did it say in its second backstory about what's called the repo market? I'll make some comments on that. A third event of the past week, infrastructure. You know, what is the state of the infrastructure follies going on, infrastructure spending bill, the fiscal bill, that started out at $2.3 trillion here back in February and now apparently is at $500 billion new money only. Keeps going down as Biden and the Dems make concession after concession to the Republicans in order to get desperately something passed that has some kind of bipartisanship. Let's talk about that a little bit. Where are we? Looks like we're coming into the final stretch, and the final bill will be $500 billion new spending. And well, why did he keep saying it's $1 trillion? Well, we'll address that. It's really only $500 billion new over, what, 5-10 years? Anyway, and then the fourth topic I want to talk about related, and we'll explain how, is the U.S. House Representatives opening its hearings on the January 6th insurrection in the Capitol. How is that tied into infrastructure and so forth and the economy? Okay, so that's the four items we're going to address here today. Okay, let's jump into GDP analysis here, what's going on with this release. Well, The numbers released show a 6.5% annual rate of increase in U.S. GDP in the second quarter. First of all, let's get off of this annual rate nonsense. You know, they like to report it in terms of an annual rate. In other words, if the growth in the second quarter continued, what would it be over a full year looking forward? You know, that kind of boosts the number. 6.5 looks a lot better than 1.6, doesn't it? Yeah, 1.6 is about roughly the average growth in the second quarter over the first quarter. You really need to look at this thing quarter to quarter, not annualized. But the U.S. likes to report annualized, you see, pumps the number up. Other economies, look at it and report primary reporting a number would be quarter over quarter. It's really 1.6, which is about what it was in the first quarter. So it's not accelerating, you see. It's not accelerating. Okay, you know, it's not bad, 1.6 quarter to quarter, believe it or not. But the big question is, will the economy be able to sustain or increase that quarterly growth rate? Well, there are indications that that quarterly growth rate is already slowing down. We'll talk about that, which is quite important, you see, quite important going forward for being able to argue there's more stimulus needed or if there's not as much stimulus. So we're going to look at that here, 1.6%. What is the 1.6%? How much really is it? And put it in context. Well, you know, if you look at 1.6%, if you look at it compared to the fourth quarter of 2019, right? You can argue that we are now at or just above where we were in the economy in the fourth quarter 2019 before the whole crisis began. Oh, well, they're saying, well, we've fully recovered, right? We're fully recovered. We're at GDP where we were. In fact, it's 0.8% above the pre-pandemic fourth quarter 2019. Oh, it's V-shaped. We've recovered, right? You know, that does not take into effect the fact that the economy after 2019 would have continued to grow modestly anyway if there weren't, you know, the 2020 pandemic impact. It would have grown. So you can't look at what you got now, fourth quarter, and compare it to a frozen GDP fourth quarter 2019. And say, oh, we've fully recovered. You got to compare what we got now to what the average growth would have continued to be in 2020 had there not been a COVID. Okay, if you do that, we're still below where the economy should have been or should be right now by 2.2%. We're really 2.2% below pre-pandemic economy. We're not up 0.8%, right? Okay, so, you know, it all depends how you want to look at it. If you want to look at a frozen economy, okay. If you want to look at a more accurate what the economy should have been if there were no COVID today compared to what it actually is today, we're still 2.2% below. Okay, so 2.2% isn't that far below, right? You might say that's a small number. Well, actually, it's not. It's in terms of GDP numbers, it's quite significant because the total drop of the economy in 2020 was minus 3.4%. Well, you say, well, that's not so bad, is it? Well, it's the worst since the post-World War II period. So 3.4% drop is pretty significant. And we're still 2.2% below if you look at where the economy should be today. Okay, so, you know, you may argue, well, you're splitting hairs, you know, whether it's 0.8 or minus 2.2? Well, not really, because when you're looking at a $2 trillion economy, these are significant numbers. Okay. Plus, you know, let me add the point I've made many times here, and that is U.S. GDP has been artificially bumped up since 2013. At that time, the U.S. redefined GDP, the components of GDP, and added things to GDP like logos and intangibles and so forth. Really, and R&D spending, which was an expense, then they started counting it as a GDP growth in 2013. And that artificially boosted GDP by $500 billion. And then they retroactively changed all the GDP numbers before 2013. Now, why did they do that back then during Obama time? Well, they did that in order to avoid the indication that the U.S. had hit a double dip recession in 2013. Yeah, we only had one quarter of contraction when it should have been even longer and therefore qualified as a recession. Well, when you redefine away the double dip recession, you know, you can say, well, there was no double dip. By the way, in Europe and Japan, there was a big double dip. So, you know, the following years from the 2008-09 crash, big contraction of the real economy, there was a double dip, right? In Europe, in Japan, even in the numbers, in the U.S., obfuscated by redefining GDP. A little historic economic history there for you, right? And that's what led me in 2010 and 12 in my books, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, and Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, to argue that we were in a great recession, or what I call an epic recession, that always extends for several years. And the big initial contraction results in an insufficient recovery, and then the economy lapses again, and GDP and growth flatten out, or actually contract, as in Europe and Japan, and even in U.S. And then you get a weak recovery from the second contraction, and you bounce along the bottom, and the whole recovery period is really 5-6 years, and it looks more like a W-shape than a V-shape. Okay, that was my thesis back then, and I argued when the COVID thing started that we're going to have a similar event, long-term event, of the deep contraction that we had in the first half of 2020. The economy contracted 10.5%. In the third quarter of 2020, as we attempted to reopen, it gained back 7.4% of that 10.5%. But the rebound, it wasn't a recovery, it was a rebound third quarter last year, faded as the stimulus of March 2020, the CARES Act, dissipated, as I predicted it would, if they didn't come with a subsequent stimulus, which they didn't, because McConnell and Trump blocked everything from the House to pass what was called the HEROES Act, which would have added a true stimulus to help the economy continue. So we didn't get the stimulus. And then we got another wave of COVID in the fall and winter. And the dissipated stimulus in 2020 and the COVID wave caused the economy to stagnate again in the fourth quarter. And we only got a 1.1% increase in GDP in the fourth quarter. That's not an annual rate, by the way. So we had a 10.5 followed by a 7.4 gain, followed by only a 1.1 gain. And that was the picture in 2020. Okay, so in 2021, we get the vaccine, and we get an end of the COVID wave of the winter here by February. So the economy begins in the first quarter to recover. Now, recover from a deep contraction, and we get, you know, the 6.4%, I think it was, annual rate of increase in the first quarter of this year, which is really 1.6 quarter to quarter. In the first quarter of 2021. Okay, so what does that do to? Well, that's due to mostly the reopening of the economy that begins in February and March of this year. Now, there was some stimulus on top of that. The COVID Relief Act, called the American Rescue Plan, did provide reportedly $1.9 trillion of stimulus. It truly was a stimulus bill, but it wasn't 1.9, it was 1.8, because at the last minute, the Republicans took out $100 billion. So it was 1.8, but only $1 trillion was authorized to be spent this year. So you can't say it's a $1.8 trillion stimulus this year. It's really going to be only a $1 trillion stimulus. And it's not even going to be that, because we're ending unemployment benefits early, right? And we're causing evictions early, and we're going to be ending forbearance on mortgages and student loans and rents here. So the ending of unemployment benefits and so forth means we're only going to get about $800 billion of new spending in the first year. And of course, the first year hasn't totally occurred. We've only got like 4 months since the stimulus authorized spending of $800 billion this 2021. There's not that much stimulus hitting the economy to be able to argue that, oh, that's causing the recovery. I don't believe it is. It's helping. It's providing some of the recovery, but it's not the significant. The significant part is the reopening of the economy going on. Now, that means those arguments that, we're spending too much. Republicans like to argue this. We're spending too much. The government's spending too much, and we're causing inflation as a result, right? And therefore, we shouldn't be spending anymore. Therefore, let's go back to austerity. Let's take some of this back that we authorized in the American Rescue Plan here, the COVID relief bill in February. Let's take some of this back. And that's what some of the Republican states are doing, right? They're ending some of the unemployment assistance early. The pandemic unemployment assistance, for freelancers and gig workers and so forth, and the extra $300, they ended that early in about half of the states. It's gone. Even then, you can't file for, in the last month or so in those states, you can't file for pandemic unemployment assistance. The backup, there's two unemployment benefit systems. There's the regular traditional state system, and then there's the supplemental federal pandemic unemployment, PUA, assistance for freelancers and gig workers and independent workers and so forth, right? Of which there's probably, 40,000, more than that, 40 million, employed in the United States. A lot of people. So they ended that early. That early ending is going to have an effect on the economy, but it really means we're not really spending the authorized $1 trillion. We are, ending that early. So, rough rule of thumb, this year, probably about $800 billion will be the amount. And then people going back to work is going to reduce the unemployment benefits as well. So the authorized $1 trillion from the COVID relief bill here will not be $1 trillion this year in terms of stimulus. It'll be much less. We don't know exactly. Maybe $600 billion, $700 billion total here. That's a minuscule stimulus to the economy compared to the reopening of the economy. Minuscule. So, the argument that we're spending too much and causing inflation is nonsense. But that's what the Republicans like, because they can use it to argue, we should pare back some of this COVID relief bill, which is what they're doing, by the way, because what they're doing is taking $200 billion of that $1.8 trillion. They're taking $200 billion out of that bill, and they're adding it to the infrastructure bill. Yeah, so maybe that $500 billion net increase in infrastructure spending is really only going to be $300 billion. Yeah, well, we'll get back to the composition of the infrastructure agreement here, but that's a little bit of a preview, right? It's not $1 trillion. It's at most $500 billion new spending over 5 years or 10 years, whatever the term is. And it may be really only $300 billion because they're moving the money around. They're taking money from COVID relief that hasn't been spent, probably would have gone to the states, and they're evicted renters, and they're putting it in another pot called the infrastructure bill. Okay. But nevertheless, the Republicans are arguing that all this stimulus is causing inflation to rise. Too much demand going on. I don't believe that. And by the way, neither does the Federal Reserve. Pretty much, if you look at inflation over the past year, or especially in the last quarter, first of all, you got to realize that these inflation numbers are year to year. We're looking at year to year. They always keep referring it year to year, right? The PCE index, which is what the Fed uses, Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, was up 3.5%. 3.5% in June over June 2020. That means that the price deflation, the price cuts that occurred during COVID, early COVID, because businesses couldn't sell stuff, so they cut their prices, is the base from which now inflation at 3.5% is measured. It's the base. So you're starting off a deflated base. That's why you get 3.5% year to year, right? It's really a false number. It's not 3.5%, really. If we had normal price increase, we didn't have COVID, probably be around 2%. Okay. And that's true for May. But they say, oh, it's up 3.5%, the largest gain since December 1991. Oh, big inflation going on. Well, you cherry pick your numbers to make your case. That's what the Republicans do and business sources do. And that's what's happening when they say 3.5%. And even further, if you look at the composition of that 3.5%, where is it? Well, I'll tell you where it is. It's in airline tickets. It's in hotel and motel prices. And it's in auto prices, especially used car prices. Those three areas make up 80% of the 3.5%. And in all three of those, the problem is supply constraints. It's not demand driven. In other words, too much money being given in these COVID relief bills, therefore we got to cut them back. No, it's supply constraint problems, supply. And you could add to that supply problems in the global supply chains where we can't get parts and intermediate products and imports back into the U.S. because what happened was during COVID, the global shipping industry just about shut down, right? And now they're trying to get it going again. And in many countries, they still won't allow ships to unload. They won't allow the sailors on the ship to leave the ships. And those ships are sitting in harbors because they have their COVID relief. Because COVID is really raging, the Delta COVID, in many places in the world. You see, it's not over. In fact, it's getting worse. So we have problems in the global shipping and global supply chain. That raises import prices. And when you add import price increases to your general price index, that raises your PCE index as well. So we got global supply problems. We've got problems, with semiconductor chips, which are the auto companies are using to drive up new car prices, which drives up used car prices, right? And then we got restaurant, hotel, motel, airline industries price gouging, trying to raise prices as much as they can, and they are, in order to make up for their price cuts last year and their loss in revenue last year. So it's recouping price cuts last year that's going on. And the Federal Reserve is arguing that, these supply problems and reopening inflation problems are going to be temporary and it's going to go away. If you buy that argument, there's a lot of truth to it. If you buy that argument, then the argument, oh, it's the demand driven. We're giving too much money to working class and median households here, and they're driving up prices. Then that argument is BS. The demand side argument is BS. And it is. It's a supply problem. You know, the question is, how long will the price gouging of some sectors reopening go on? How long will the auto companies keep using the excuse of chip shortages to keep raising prices? You know, those are the real questions here. Will that be, will that dissipate in another 2-3 months that the Fed hopes, or will that continue to go on? Well, we'll talk about more what the Fed thinks of that when we look at Federal Chair Powell's meeting and press conference this past week, all right? But let's get back to GDP. Let's get back to GDP. Right. Okay. So if you look at GDP, let's look again at the 6.4%, 6.5%, right? And how much of that is due to what's going on in certain sectors of the economy? Well, first of all, consumer spending is about 2/3, 70% of GDP. So if you want to know what happened to the 6.5%, or actually 1.6% quarter to quarter, you got to look at consumer spending. That's where most of the action is in the second quarter GDP. Well, consumer spending, right, is on goods, in other words, discrete things that you buy, particularly big ticket goods like cars and houses and so forth, right, and services of all kinds. Now, in the U.S. economy, the GDP, about 20% of the GDP is on goods purchases, goods, discrete things, long-lasting goods, right? And 80% on services. Okay, so if you look at good spending, right, good spending rose only 0.5% of that 6.5%, right? Only 0.5% was on goods. And actually, long-lasting goods like cars and so forth decreased 1.5% in the second quarter, right? Non-durable goods, in other words, gasoline and stuff like that, foodstuffs and so forth, increased. But long-term goods, big-ticket items, actually decreased. So if you're looking at housing, right, the same thing. Housing is slowing down because of shortages and price increases, pretty much taking a lot of people out of the housing market. So goods production, manufactured goods and housing, flat at best, not contributing much, if any at all, to that 1.6% increase or 6.5% annualized last quarter, right? So all of the consumer spending, right, really had to do with what's going on in services, right? And yes, households are spending more on services as the economy opens up. They are spending, you know, on retail. They are spending on restaurants and bars. They are spending on hotels and airlines and so forth, right? And that's, by the way, the excuse the airlines and others are trying to use to recoup as much as they can in price increases. By the way, you know, digression here on the airlines are gouging everybody after they got $52 billion in subsidies from the U.S. government over the past year. $52 billion that they got with the promise that they were going to hire or not lay off their workers. Well, they took the $52 billion and they did it anyway. And we got a problem in the airline industry of a lot of unemployed workers still there. Congress gives them $52 billion, one industry, right? And they don't adhere to their agreement not to lay people off. They lay people off anyway. So, you know, they're doing pretty darn good, the airlines. They were protected. Can't say that for certain other sectors. Right. Okay, so airline tickets, used cars, hotel and motel, just about all of the inflation in increase, but also reflects that that's where the spending has been going on. Now, that's a rebound from depression contraction and depression lows. Depression last year, 2020, you know, same quarter, second quarter, 2020, right? And that's to be expected. You get a rebound when you're reopening the economy, okay? Well, you know, excluding inflation, consumer spending rebounded a half of 1% in June, but it dropped 0.6% in May. What's going on? Why do we have this big contraction in May and just about making up what the contraction was in June? You net it out, not that much net increase for a rebound going on. Well, that's because some sectors of the economy are rebounding and other sectors are not rebounding. And, you know, manufacturing and construction are pretty much stagnant, not growing anymore. Well, that's because, you know, manufacturing grew significantly last year. It wasn't affected by COVID very much, manufactured goods. And, you know, there's not that much growth for it to squeeze out. It's not going to continue growing at the rate it did last year. So its contribution to GDP in the second quarter and going forward is pretty minimal. You're not going to see a lot of contribution to further recovery from the manufacturing sector, nor from the housing sector. Right? That 20% of the economy is going to be pretty flat. So what we got in the other 80%, of course, is rebound going on in the economy, particularly in services, and particularly in those services that really took the big hit in 2020. Now, economists argue, and they say, well, you know, we got a lot of backup going in the economy that's really going to keep things going, you know. They say, well, you know, personal income, you know, has a lot to spend there, and the savings is excess. Added during the pandemic, you know, households saved a lot of extra money, and wages are rising, right? And all of these things will mean wage increases going on, and big savings backlog existing. The savings rate is up, right? The stock market is up. You know, the wealth effect is up, so that consumer spending is going to keep raging here. It's going to continue to accelerate. I'm not so sure whether that's true. Right? And if it's not true, then the rebound in the third quarter will be a repeat here of the third quarter 2020 rebound that then dissipated. Why? Well, first of all, the wealth effect, stock market. Well, the people who you know, enjoy the gains from the stock prices appreciation, stock market, are only the wealthy. The wealthy 5% maybe are those who will really, really get their wealth effect. Now, the wealth effect, the wealthier you are, the more you're apt to spend it, right? So the wealth effect is one way stimulating consumer spending, but only for the very high-level households, right? And it's a fact that high-level households do not spend most of their income gains, you know, maybe half of it or less. They're the ones who are hoarding all the savings, you see. The savings rate is way up, yes, but it's up concentrated among the wealthiest households. And they mostly reinvest that, and mostly reinvest it in financial assets, which does nothing for the economy and its future growth. So, you know, if the savings rate is high and it's concentrated at the high-end wealthy, it's irrelevant as far as stimulating consumption. You know, in the same thing that you could say about the wealth effect. Okay, so there's a third force here that they argue is generating and will continue to generate consumption growth here, and that's wages and salaries, right? Which were up 1% in the first quarter after and now in the second quarter, 0.9%, right? 3.2% year on year. Largest increase in second quarter 2008, right? In annualized terms, you know, about 3% average here in the first half. Wage gains, right? Well, most of the wage gains were led by the leisure and hospitality sector. In other words, workers refuse to go back unless these hotels and restaurants, which are paying them minimal pay, pay them more, right? Workers are looking for other better jobs because they're tired of being whipsawed here by this particular industry, workers in this industry, right? So, yeah, there's a problem of getting workers back to those low-pay jobs. And by the way, did you know minimum wage for workers in restaurants is not $7.25? No, it's not. It's not even $3. Because they have a special minimum wage per hour for workers in that industry, assuming that they get $7.25 from tips. Yeah, yeah, they cut workers' wages, guaranteed wages, minimum wages in that long time ago, right? So workers are tired of working in that industry, and they're looking for something else. Mm-hmm. So that means that if they want to get people back quickly, the employers in restaurants and bars have to pay them more, and that's what they're trying to do. And that's why you get most of the wage increase in that sector in recent months. But that's going to level off, and we don't see a similar big increase in wages elsewhere, in other sectors, other occupations, other industries. No, we don't see it. So, you know, this wage and salary growth going to continue to accelerate, I don't believe that either. And you add that to the wealth effect affecting just a small slice at the top income household level and most of the savings rate up there. And that wealth effect and savings rate is going to continue to be hoarded income, right? And wage and salaries is not across the board growth everywhere. You don't have this big push behind consumer spending that's going to continue into the second half of this year, in my view. Okay. So the truth is always in the details, you see, and you got to get behind the hype that you get in the media here about, oh, how great the economy is doing, right? It's not doing all that great. What we got is a rebound. You got to distinguish between a rebound and a sustained recovery. So far, what I see is reopening of the economy and a rebound. And wages are not really pushing into a sustained level of recovery, aren't pushing consumer spending, 70% of the economy and GDP, not really pushing it. And what we got is a dissipating of the COVID relief spending, you know, the American Rescue Plan of February. That's running out. The checks have run out. Unemployment is about to be discontinued. People are about to be evicted. Forbearances on rents and mortgages and student loans are about to be ended, right? All that's going to have a negative effect. And then, of course, we got this COVID thing raising its ugly head once again, the Delta variant, right? What's going to happen with the Delta variant here? Will it result in some further shutdowns? Well, it might, not likely. You know, because we got vaccinations now. They'll hold out, try to get vaccinations. They won't shut down again. But it's going to have some effect on people not wanting to spend on services and in sectors where they have to go out and meet a lot of other people, right? Movie theaters and stuff like that, right? So it'll have some effect, not as much as it did last year. But it will have more effect probably on global trade, you see. Which is part of GDP, what we call net exports. You know, COVID is raging in many parts of the world and getting worse, this Delta variant. You know, we only got half of the people vaccinated here in the U.S. Well, in other places, they have single digit vaccinations going on. So it's ravaging the economies there. And if that's so, then, you know, the trade in goods and goods, particularly that the U.S. depends upon, exports, imports, is going to be impacted, too. And that's going to reduce further future GDP. You know, if you look at GDP, there's four elements, right? There's consumer spending, which is almost 70%. There's government spending, which is 20-25%. There is investment, business investment, maybe 10%. And then there's the difference between exports and imports, which you call net exports. And if it's negative, in other words, if we're importing more than exporting, that detracts from the total GDP numbers. Four sectors, right? Well, we just talked about the consumer sector, you know, and the realities there. The government sector, we got a dissipation, a fading of the COVID, and the infrastructure bill is not going to do anything this year. And even next year, it'll be minimal. So infrastructure spending, if it's approved, isn't going to do anything. So, nix the government contribution to a robust recovery here. And then you got business investment. Yeah, there's some investment picking up, but it's only 10% of GDP, total GDP. And businesses are working off their inventory. So we may get some more inventory spending. But who knows how much when. And then you got net exports, which is a negative to GDP, which is going forward if the global COVID situation continues to whack global trade, then that will be an increased detraction from GDP. So you look at GDP going forward, I'm not all that optimistic in the second half that we're going to continue to see a sustained recovery. What we're seeing is a second rebound. Perhaps a stronger rebound than we had last year, but a rebound is not a sustained recovery. And the risk is high, even according to Moody Analytics, that we can have a, quote, downside risks remain large, according to Moody Analytics. This is a business company that does a lot of forecasting and data analysis, right? We'll see what happens. But I'm not totally convinced this is a total V-shaped recovery. And remember, V-shape is just the first half of a W, right? If we have a stagnation and a slowdown in growth by the fourth quarter next year, which we will have if we don't get further stimulus, right? And if COVID becomes a factor again, if we don't have real wage growth occurring, not just in select industries now, then we will have a significant slowdown in GDP. We could even stagnate. Places like Europe and Japan and elsewhere will have a second double-dip recession. Then it becomes a W-shape, you see. A W-shape is a great recession, is an epic recession, which you got to look at long-term, you see. You can't say V-shape, we're fully recovered if we're going to sag again. Subsequently to all this, great recessions are short, shallow recoveries followed by similar short, shallow relapses. Got to distinguish between rebounds, relapses, and sustained recovery. I'm not convinced we're in a sustained recovery yet. Okay, so let's move on to the Fed and the Fed's meeting. Excuse me. Well, Chairman Powell met last, the Fed Open Market Committee that determines interest rates met last week, and they decided that they weren't convinced that this was a sustained recovery either, and they decided to keep pumping $120 billion a month into banks and investors. Since this thing began, the Fed has pumped $4 trillion into banks and investors who didn't really have a crisis. Look at the stock market. It just kept booming, going. There was no crisis in the banking system. This was not 2008-09. So why did they throw $4 trillion? They increased their balance sheet, the Fed did, its debt level, by $4 trillion. That's how much money at $120 billion a month, plus other initial means they use, to throw money at the banks that weren't even in a crisis. And no one's complaining about that. No one's saying, hey, let's pare back. We throw a lot of money at banks. They weren't even in crisis. And now we're arguing over a couple $100 billion for households, $53 billion to pay back rents for those who couldn't pay them. We're arguing about that. Why the Fed keeps getting pumping $120 billion a month. We're arguing about, $52 billion for back rents. By the way, as of last week, the government only paid $3 billion of that $52 billion allocated for back rent payments, and they're evicting people now. Yeah. It kind of shows you where they really want to throw their money. They, meaning the paid politicians of corporate America, right? Investor America. So, you know, the Fed decided last week it was going to continue $120 billion. Wasn't convinced. And the whole discussion in the press conference with Chairman Powell was about, well, when are you going to raise rates? Well, Powell has always been saying when we have, quote, substantial further progress. Progress in what? In reaching maximum unemployment and controlling prices. You see, those two missions of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, right? Well, you know, yes, inflation is 3.4% year on year, and the Fed's target is 2%. But the Fed is saying, you know, this is temporary. This is temporary for reasons we've already discussed. Well, as I said, we'll see whether how temporary it's going to be. But, you know, they've reached their one goal of 2% inflation index. But they're not so convinced, the Fed, that they reached maximum employment. Right? They keep saying, oh, we got 8, 9 million people still not jobless compared to 2019. Actually, we got 15 million. There's 15 million people on unemployment benefits. Still, 500,000 official number every week filing for unemployment benefits. And it's probably more because they cut it out in some states. 500,000 a week, first time filing. And if you look at how many people are on unemployment benefits, you know, we got 12 to 15 million people. Plus, we got 3 to 4 million people dropped out of the labor force. Plus, we got at least a million moms or dads staying home watching their kids until schools really reopen. There's at least 15 million people, not 8, 9 million. But even the Fed says 8.9 million, you know, shows us the labor market is not all that great. It's getting better. You know, the Fed doesn't look at just unemployment numbers. They look at employment growth trends. They look at job openings, you know, long-term duration unemployment and labor force participation and so forth. They look at a number of things to determine whether the labor market is in good shape or not. And they don't see it, you know, really that great a shape. And of course it isn't, because we are in a job. If you look at recovery in terms of joblessness, you know, a jobless recovery, which occurred in 2008-9, we didn't get back to the level of jobs until 2015, even though GDP recovered within a year. And of course, that's what we got now. You know, oh, GDP is fully recovered. But the jobs haven't recovered, and it's going to take years again, once again, for the jobs to recover. If you look at jobs, there's no back to where we were going on, right? The Fed also, you know, raised the question of there's a divergence in global growth among economies here. You know, they recognize that COVID is raging elsewhere in the world, and growth rates, even recessions, are occurring elsewhere in the world because of COVID. And that's impacting financial markets and trade. So no recovery on the global side, right? And then Powell said, quote, let me quote about COVID effect. You know, they're still not convinced that this COVID thing is over and its effect on the economy. In his press conference, Powell said, quote, no reason why strains can't keep coming and one more powerful than the next, unquote. Okay, Delta, much worse than Alpha. Alpha being the initial strain, Delta, much worse. And they still don't know exactly how much worse. You know, what are the long-term effects? They don't really know. And they know it's much more contagious, twice as contagious. If it's twice as contagious, that means you're getting a bigger load of the virus. And a bigger load of the virus can mean that, you know, more serious effects, more likely hospitalizations, and deaths. And now it's beginning to appear that even those folks vaccinated can be asymptomatic and carriers of it and spread it. Spread the Delta. They may get it, don't even know it because they're vaccinated, and they spread it to the rest. Okay. So, you know, Powell's pretty worried about this. He's not willing to give up on this. But he did, you know, on inflation said, well, it's mostly cars, airline tickets, and hotels. And that, of course, he's right. But he's assuming it's going to end pretty soon. That's not so sure. I'm not so sure, right? But he does say we're a ways away from full employment. He's right about that, right? And he's not going to start raising rates until it's clear on the employment side that the labor market has recovered. He was asked a question, you know, why do we have 9 million unemployed and 9.2 million job openings? Well, he added and explained, I think he's accurate in this, right? He says, we really have an unusual situation of high unemployment, right, and rising inflation. Well, we used to call that stagflation, right? Big problem in the 70s and 80s. Well, he added, well, why? Why do we have such a large number of unemployed, which is an underestimation, right? And officially, 9 million is really 15 million. Well, he says people are looking for new jobs. They're not going back to their old jobs. Well, we talked about that, particularly in restaurants and bars, right? Some are reluctant to go back due to COVID, right? And if COVID, the Delta rages, you know, even more so. Schools aren't fully open yet. We have a problem with elder care, right? And unemployment benefits are rolling off. All right, so these are all explanations of why, you know, the job market has not really recovered, right? And he's worried about COVID waves, you know, right? He said, well, we're just going to have to see what's happening, COVID waves. And he made a distinction between price increases and inflation. Now, that sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it, right? Well, what he really means is that we got price increases going on that are temporary, and inflation is really whether we have inflationary expectations. You know, if prices are rising and people expect them to rise, they go out and do things that drive them prices even higher. That's inflationary expectations. But he says there's no evidence of this yet, right? But he's looking at inflation. In short, you know, they're keeping throwing $120 billion a month into the economy because they don't see a real solution yet. Convincing to the labor market hasn't fully recovered, and they're waiting to see whether inflation is more than just temporary here. So that summarizes. But I want to say something else about what the Fed did last week. What the Fed did last week was to quietly, you know, backstory to the whole announcement, said it's making a permanent facility, as they called it, out of providing funds to what's called the repo market, right? Repurchase agreements. Well, what is that? Well, that's a financial market out there in which the Fed provides bonds. It buys and sells bonds into that market. Now, that's in addition to the traditional way that the Fed buys and sells bonds and provides money injections into the general banking system. This is like a second conduit. This is like a second fire hose here of providing money into the economy, pushing it into the repo market. What is the repo market? Well, that's where investors and speculators and more shadow bankers, private equity and so forth, borrow money in order to invest in stocks and bonds and so forth using treasuries, treasury bonds and notes and bills as securities to borrow, you know, as collateral to borrow money short term to speculate with. Now, back in September 2019, we had a crisis in that market because there wasn't enough treasuries being provided into that market in order to support the amount of borrowing by the shadow bankers to speculate in financial markets. And there was a crisis in the repo market as a result. And the Fed had to put $1.5 trillion into that market to prevent a collapse of the repo market, which would have been, you know, another 2008 event. And ever since then, the Fed has continued as those debts and borrowing rolled off, putting more money back in. So now the repo market is $1 trillion, $1 trillion in rolling debt. And it's a second fire hose to provide free money to investors and speculators, in addition to the major traditional method of pumping money into the banks, that the Fed has undertaken. So the Fed is throwing more and more money into banks and stocks and bonds and financial and speculators than ever before. It's subsidizing financial asset markets. And now we got the second fire hose, the second conduit called the repo market. And the Fed said last week, we're going to make it permanent. We're going to keep putting $1 trillion, make sure that the repo market and speculators can continue. Okay, so that's the Fed. What about infrastructure? Well, we got this infrastructure phony negotiations going on. We started out with $2.3 trillion in infrastructure bill. Then it was $1.7 trillion. Biden reduced it in order to get bipartisan support, right? You can't even get bipartisan support with his own blue dog, Democrat senators, Sinema and Manchin, right? They are the front running interference for the corporate wing of the Democratic Party that really doesn't want to spend much more money. They want the economy to open up and see what happens. That's the Republican Mitch McConnell position. Oh, we don't need more money. Let's let it open and see how far we can go before we spend more. Well, that's what the corporate wing of the Democratic Party is all about, right? And that's where Biden is. And that's why he cut his spending to 1.7 and then down to $1 trillion for the infrastructure bill, right? And then he agreed to $579 billion of new money, and let's count money already authorized here for transport spending over 10 years. We'll add that to the $579 billion. We'll add the $384 billion for that to $579 billion. And, then we'll move a little bit more money around here and there. And what we got is $1 trillion. Well, it's not $1 trillion. It's only $500 billion, latest count. They went down from $579 to $500 billion. Cut infrastructure spending. It's really the Mitch McConnell bill right now. And why? Because McConnell and the corporate wing Democratic Party do not want to do much more spending, because then they will have to raise taxes on corporations and investors in order to pay for it. And the number one objective of McConnell and the corporate wing of the Democrats is they don't want to take away any of the Trump $4 trillion tax cuts. That's what's really behind all this concession, using bipartisanship as an excuse, and using Manchin and Sinema to take the heat, the lead on all this, and refusing to do budget reconciliation on all this, and refusing to stop the filibuster, That's what's behind this. Preserve the Trump $4 trillion tax cuts for corporations and the rich. Because if you spend much more, you're going to have to raise. This infrastructure bill, no tax increases in this. They've all been taken away. They're going to be paid by phony moving the money around, raising gasoline taxes on everybody, right? And moving money around from Medicare, private public partnership. Nonsense. That's how they're going to pay for all this. No tax cuts. In fact, Democrats wanted to, we won't raise new taxes. Let's just make sure we collect old taxes and give some money to the IRS to do a better job. Well, Republicans didn't even want that. And, of course, Biden begs off from that. And what we got is a McConnell bill here, $500 billion, if it passes. Yeah, it probably will pass, but it'll have no effect on stimulating the economy this year and making sure we get a sustained recovery. And what happens to the $3.5 trillion Sanders bill of all the other non-corporate, non-business spending for, spending for households, elderly care, child care, and all the other spending, $3.5 trillion, the Family Act, the third part. First part was COVID relief, second part was infrastructure, third part is family relief. What happened to that? Will we have budget reconciliation to pass that? No, it's dead on arrival. You will never see that act passed. We are in the realm of return to austerity on fiscal policy while the Fed keeps pumping trillions of dollars into bankers and investors. And that's what the Democratic recovery plan really looks like. And that's why we will not get a sustained recovery.